See all your smiling faces. We'll see if they are still smiling after you hear me for way too long. Well, we've been going over the account of Jesus' birth. We're continuing on that journey, and we kind of finished out his birth. And while there are parts of his life that are recorded in between his birth and what we'll be talking about today of his baptism, we're going to jump to the baptism and looking at that. Diving right into that, I think if we go ahead and reread the account of Christ's baptism, it's actually in some semblance or another recorded in all four of the Gospels for us to see it through the lens of our own experiences. Perhaps you, when you've read it, have thought about your own baptism. Maybe you were baptized in a pool, a horse trough, a river, a lake. We've had a few here who were baptized in hot tubs. To try and place ourselves more into the cultural context of what it might have been like there for people who are experiencing or witnessing the baptism of Jesus. So in this first message today, we're going to look at the background of one of those components of Jesus' baptism, which is water. We probably don't think too much about water. I mean, we have easy access to clean, potable water. We have the wonderful miracle blessing of indoor plumbing. It wasn't too long ago. There may be some here who remember that. Having to go out to another structure. We have, Morton's got some great pools. You can go there. People swim for fun. This concept of water, the amount of water that you can have access to, is just abnormal in time. It's also abnormal, globally speaking. One of the biggest things that a lot of outreach programs do is to try to be able to get boreholes or wells drilled and dug for individuals in areas where there isn't access to good, clean, consistent water outside of the rainy season and those sorts of endeavors. Now, it can also be a little bit of a challenge for us because we're sitting here, we have all the amenities of Western society, that we could also fall into the mindset that we're looking back and, well, those people, I mean, they lived in rock houses. They really didn't have all that much. They weren't very progressed. But at the same time, we're like, oh, a really nice house is a brick house, right? Isn't that a rock? But back then, water was accessible. And in the land of Judea, average people could go get water. Now, you had to go get water. You didn't just go turn on the tap. My dad gifted me a faucet, which I'm getting to the age where I'm like, that's amazing. I just touch it and it turns on. I don't even have to do that. I mean, so pedestrian to have to turn the faucet now. I can't be bothered with that. I'm kidding. It's like a lot of fun though. It's got less splashes on the counter now. Really enjoy that. But I don't have to go anywhere. I hardly have to do a thing to get water. That was not the case at the time in Judea for people who are around during the life and times of Jesus Christ. So they had access to water. In fact, in and around Jerusalem, not too far, there are three known springs. One of them you are probably very familiar with, and that was the Gihon Spring, which is the one that the Tunnel of Hezekiah was dug in order to reroute during the siege that Babylon had on the city of Jerusalem as they're trying to take that over. Sorry, not that was Sennacherib. Wrong guy. Sennacherib was putting them under siege. And so Hezekiah goes, he digs the tunnel to bring the Gihon Spring from outside of the city walls to inside of the city walls. And it's a pretty substantial, it is the most substantial spring that is there in the Jerusalem area. Another one is the Pool of Siloam, which you might be familiar with it as you read through the Gospels, as far as an area where people would go in order to be healed. If the bubbles were there, they were agitated, somebody could be healed. But you have the Pool of Siloam, and this was one that it was dug out, actually. It wasn't a large volume spring. If you go and you start to try to get water, you're talking about how many feet down. If you're going to pay a well driller, you're going to pay by the foot. Maybe you're going to hit water. Maybe you're not. Maybe you hit water, and maybe it's not quite the flow rate that you would need to have as far as gallons per minute. Maybe it's really muddy, and you have to have all these different things that a well driller will know about as far as getting the right amount of water at the volume. And so the Pool of Siloam was not as heavy of a producer of water as the Gihon Spring was, but it was enough to have a small pool there. Generally speaking, at the time of Jesus, it wasn't an issue, but as Israel has grown and they built up, then it's no longer as that spring that feeds it is not able to keep up. The third one was the Liftah Spring. Now this is up in I think it's in the Palestinian area, a little bit farther north of Jerusalem. It's a question as to whether or not it was actually in Judea or if it was on the Benjamin side of the border for where it was. But it was also one that just didn't quite have the production that Gihon did. But you have three springs, three water sources within the city to go to be able to gather water. Now, springs burble. If you've been down to, if you've seen a natural spring, they'll bubble up. They kind of effervesce up from the ground, and they come up and they'll fill in the area, which is why you would oftentimes dig out and around the spring to be able to capture it, to have enough volume to be able to scoop out what you would need. As far as precipitation, Jerusalem gets, on average, 21 inches of precipitation. That includes, I mean, they're not really getting snow, but I mean, that's primarily your rain, some dew and things like that. 21 inches of precipitation per year. That might not seem like anything to be able to place, but here in the Peoria area, we get about 40, 42 inches of precipitation per year. So they're getting about half of the amount of water that we get. And you might say, well, that's not too bad. But I'll remind you that one of the things that really helps us around here is grass and trees. Because what those do is they absorb and they keep the moisture and they keep the water content in the area. This is one of the things that I had the joy of being able to witness when I moved from Ohio to Arizona, where my wife's family was. When I was out there, I witnessed what they call a river. And it was blue on the map when I was looking at the GPS. And I looked out the window over the edge. I was like, that's not a river. There's no water there. Because in the desert, it only fills up when you get the rain. And then it fills up, and they tell you, don't drive through a wash, don't be in that area, because if something happens to you, we're going to charge you, because we've warned you. The fire department charges you to pull you out of those areas, because you should be smart enough not to go drive through an arroyo or a wash at the time that the rain is happening, because all the water goes there, and then all the water is gone. So those 21 inches that Jerusalem is getting, you got to catch it. And if you don't catch it and keep it, then you don't have it. So even though they get, you know, half as much rain and precipitation as we do here in the year, being able to retain it was a difficult thing. And the reason we're talking about water is it's kind of an important thing for looking at the idea of baptism, right? Water's kind of important. So let's go, let's start off going to Genesis chapter 2. Genesis chapter 2, we see here a relationship between God, his people, and water. In Genesis chapter 2, we're here, kind of it's after the creation account, but we see a little bit more detail that he gives us. In Genesis chapter 2, we'll read verses 7 through 15. Genesis chapter 2, verses 7 through 15. So the Lord God formed man of the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life. And man became a living being. So he has made man. And then we see, so the Lord God planted a garden eastward in Eden, and there he put the man whom he had formed. And out of the ground the Lord God made every tree grow that is pleasant to the sight and good for food. The tree of life was also in the midst of the garden, and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Now a river went out of Eden to water the garden. And from there it parted and became four riverheads. The name of the first is the Pishon. It is the one which skirts the whole land of Havilah, and there is gold. And the gold of that land is good. Delium and the onyx stone are there. The name of the second river is Gihon. It is the one that goes with children of Israel, the people with whom he is working. It actually goes even before Israel. Because we have this here for Adam and Eve being placed into the garden. Then you think about Noah. Water has a big part in that story. You think about Isaac. The dispute over the well. Jacob having the same disputes over the water and access to that. You go to the children of Israel. Let's turn over to Exodus chapter 15. Exodus chapter 15. Exodus 15, verse 22, we see an account that is recorded here. Israel had been brought out of Egypt. And in here, in verse 15 of Exodus, verse 22 of Exodus 15, it says, Moses brought Israel from the Red Sea. That was a big water event. And then they went out into the wilderness of Shur. And they went 3 days in the wilderness, and they found... And what did they do? They murmur, they complain, they let God know that they'd have been better off somewhere else. What shall we drink, they say in verse 24. So God provides for them, he provides water. And we see after Adam and Eve are kicked out of the garden, vibrant, living petri dish for mankind, I guess you could say. You have this struggle constantly between whether people have water, enough water, too much water, the kind of water they have. And it's an amazing theme throughout Scripture, throughout the time of the patriarchs. We can see another one. I'm here with the children of Israel, not too far after this one in chapter 15, but in verse 1 of 17, Exodus 17. Exodus 17, verse 1. It says, then all the congregation of the children of Israel set out on their journey from the wilderness of Sin, according to the commandment of the Lord, and camped in Rephidim. But there was no water for the people to drink. Therefore the people contended with Moses and said, give us water that we may drink. So Moses said to them, why do you contend with me? Why do you tempt the Lord? And the people thirsted there for water, and the people complained against Moses and said, why is it you have brought us up out of Egypt? To kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst. So Moses cried out to the Lord, saying, what shall I do with the people? They are already almost ready to stone me. And the Lord said to Moses, go on before the people. Take with you some of the elders of Israel. Also take in your hand your rod with which you struck the river, and go. Behold, I will stand before you, therefore, there on the rock in Horeb. And you shall strike the rock, and the water will come out of it, and the people may drink. And Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel. So he called the name of the place Massah and Meribah because of the contention of the children of Israel and because they tempted the Lord, saying, is the Lord among us or not? So this relationship between people's need for water, we need to have it. We can't survive without it. And we have people contending with Moses, but really contending with God as to whether or not he is there and able to provide for them, willing to provide for them in the midst of desolation. You know, when Adam and Eve got kicked out, I think it's interesting, part of the conversation, and there might be some more study into this that could be had. Being made from the ground, and the word in Hebrew for ground as opposed to the word that God uses to describe Adam, he says, you are from the dust of the ground. Well, that, what is dust? It's dirt without water. And then you have him say, you're by the sweat of your brow, you're going to toil in the dust to be able to get your livelihood. And so we have people vying to get water, vying to be able to have sustenance in an area that once had it. Another interesting just sidebar here, if you go and you look at, there's a reference to Sodom and Gomorrah, and it says, you know, Sodom and Gomorrah, what was it like when Lot looked at it? He's like, oh, it's a vibrant plain. It's lush. There's all this area for me and for my herds, and that, so he chose the plains. After Sodom and Gomorrah are destroyed, we find out that it's a pretty desolate area. It changed. It was not lush and vibrant anymore. It didn't have the same oasis kind of appeal that it had once had. So we see here again this contention, a desire for water, but then God also using it, hopefully, to bring people along to see what he can provide. Let's turn over to John chapter 4. John chapter 4, we'll read verses 5 through 15, and an amazing interaction between Jesus and a Samaritan woman. John chapter 4, verse 5 through 15. So Jesus came to a city of Samaria, which is called Sychar, near the plot of ground that Jacob gave to his son Joseph. Now Jacob's well was there. Now this is a reference. Remember, Jacob dug a lot of wells. There was contention over the wells, and his herdsmen, and I think it was the herdsmen of Abimelech, contended over them. So Jacob's well was there, and Jesus, therefore being wearied from his journey, sat thus by the well. It was about the sixth hour, so it was right around noon, midday. A woman of Samaria came to draw water, and Jesus said to her, "Give me a drink," for his disciples had gone away into the city to buy food. And the woman of Samaria said to him, "How is it that you, being a Jew, ask a drink from me, a Samaritan woman? For Jews have no dealings with Samaritans." And Jesus answered and said to her, "If you knew the gift of God, and who it is who says to you, 'Give me a drink,' you would have asked him, and he would have given you living water." And the woman said to him, "Sir, you have nothing to draw with, and the well is deep. Where then do you get that living water? Are you greater than our father Jacob, who gave us the well and drank from it himself, as well as his sons and his livestock?" Jesus said to her, "Whoever drinks of this water will thirst again. But whoever drinks of the water that I shall give him will never thirst. But the water that I shall give him will become in him a fountain of water springing up into everlasting life." And the woman's response to him is, "Sir, give me this water that I may not thirst, nor come here to draw." You see this disconnect of what he's promising. And it really does hearken all the way back. In the last message, we talked about how God, he starts his work and he completes it. We see him not only completing a work through the birth of Jesus, but also pointing to the future. Well, Jesus here, talking with someone who has a little bit of historical knowledge, although somewhat incorrectly so, as a Samaritan in her concept of her heritage being Israelitish. But he's hearkening all the way back to what God provides as far as water. You could say all the way back to Genesis 2. God provided living water, water that fed the tree that man could have chosen from, but man chose the other tree. And he's offering her, but she doesn't quite grasp it. And this is one of those things when we're thinking about water, we're thinking about baptism, and we think about the individuals who were there at the time. This is a pretty good encapsulation, a microcosm of how people might have thought about baptism and water at the time. For her, it's just like when he said, you know, my body is bread indeed. People are thinking about food. Oh, he tells them, well, just take out the bread and the fish and feed them. It's like, well, did he bring food? Because we don't really have much of anything. They're so stuck looking at the physical side of things. And that, for them, is what water was used for. That's what it was good for. Because, let's jump to a second point here when we're talking about water. This water, in this case, it's for drinking and it's for life sustenance. But water at that time was also, other than drinking it, what do you do with water? You wash with it, right? Whether yourself or other things. Ritual washings were a huge thing for the Jews. Huge. But this wasn't just at that time. You can't just say, well, it's because the Pharisees had made it all this ritualistic. Because you go back, God had Israelites. If you were to bring a burnt offering before God, you were to wash it. It was to be slaughtered and it was to be washed. The high priest was to wash himself before he went into the Holy of Holies. Sick people were told to wash themselves by the priest. Go and wash yourself. I also think of, I didn't put his name in here, starts with an N, the general for Syria. Elisha tells him, go and wash in the river. Nahum. Thank you. Nahum. Nahum. See? There we go. Naaman. Naaman? There we go. We're going to get it. Thank you so much. I didn't have it written down. Rock on. So, they were told to wash themselves, and also people who were ritualistically unclean. Basis with 12 different wells and these other things. But one of the other miracles is as they're going through this barren area, God's providing water throughout the time so that they can do these ritualistic washings. One of the things, if you're to do a little bit more study into Jewish traditions, when there's two types of washings, one of those is netilat yadayim, and that is the washing of the hands. So sometimes I'll use a cup or some sort of a dipper to pour over to wash, depending on whether that's part of the ritual or not. And they do this upon awakening. There's an actual blessing that they will recite when they wake up, thanking God for the opportunity to go out and to have health and to have vitality and life. When they wake up, around meals, when you're using the restroom facilities, prior to taking the Passover, and prior to prayer. A second type of washing, ritual washing, that is there as part of the Jewish culture and was also a part of, it shouldn't just culture, because this is something that God gave to all 12 tribes, not just one of the 12. So what God commanded then is to have also at times a full body washing, which is a tevelah. So a full body immersion. And this was to be done instead of having you could have a bowl of water to do the netelet. You could have a bowl of water or something like that. But in order to do an immersion, a tevelah, you had to have what was called living water. And what living water is movement. And if you go to some of the old Jewish settlements and even in some of the other areas that are being used today in Jerusalem, they'll have what are called mikvahs. And those are ceremonial washing places. They would oftentimes be at a spring, because you have the movement of water, but it would be naturally filled. And this is a concept you can say, well, that has to do with being clean and taking care of sanitary things. And perhaps so. But there's a whole amazing analogy with this when you talk about it being living water, moving water. Again, they would use this for at a mikvah. You could have a stream, a spring, a river, or again, a mikvah, which was oftentimes kind of like a well slash cistern built around a spring for them to use. Now, people who would do the tevelah, the full body immersion, this was done if you had bodily discharges, if you had illness, if you had contact with a corpse. So if you think about the men who had touched a dead body prior to the Passover, and they asked Moses, well, what are we supposed to do? How are we supposed to go about things? Right, they would have had to do a ritual washing. It wasn't just, well, pour water over my hands. It's not, no, we're talking about a full immersion. So if you had contact with a corpse, they would also have at times, in preparation of a dead body, they would also wash the body itself, almost not in the same fashion as you would for a sacrifice. But there were times when that would happen. And this is also the type of washing that was done on the Day of Atonement for the high priest prior to him going into the Holy of Holies. Let's go to Matthew chapter 15. Matthew chapter 15, verse 1. I'll read just a couple verses there. These ritual washings were very much alive and well at the time of Jesus. And we see him being confronted about this by the Jews who are in authority and power. Matthew chapter 15, verse 1, the scribes and the Pharisees, they were from Jerusalem. They're coming from a city area. Now, again, remember that for Jesus, we'll get into this a little bit later on, but the majority of his ministry actually happened not in Jerusalem. The majority of his ministry happened up in Galilee, some in Samaria. And if you remember, we'll pull maps up in the second message, but if you just remember geographically, or if you want to turn to the back of your Bible where your maps are, you would have the Sea of Galilee, Jordan River going north-south that connects to the Dead Sea. Now, Jerusalem would be slightly to the northern end of the Dead Sea, but on the west side, okay? And it's farther to the west. And then you go up, and then you have the Sea of Galilee, and Nazareth is going to be on the west side of the Sea of Galilee. But they're about, as I mentioned when we were talking about the journey of Joseph and Mary, they're about 85 miles apart from up there in Nazareth coming down. So you got a little bit of distance between the Sea of Galilee and the Dead Sea. But these are Jews who are coming up from Jerusalem to where Jesus is preaching, and they say to him, why do your disciples transgress the tradition of the elders? For they do not wash their hands when they eat bread. So they're talking about the Netelet Yadayim. Why aren't they doing the ritual washings? So there's actually rules for washing your hands regarding eating. And what they were is, you're supposed to do that as long as, so if you're on a journey, generally speaking, you should have the water to wash your hands. But if you're going on a journey, then if there is water along your route within 4 miles. Now, it's not our 4 miles. This would be biblical miles, which is 2,000 cubits is a mile. I'd have to take that times 1.5 to get you somewhere around 3,000 to 4,000 feet. So it's less than our mile. But still, if you have water along your journey within 4 biblical miles, you can't eat until you get to that water. Now, if you have passed it and you get hungry, as long as it's within 1 biblical mile, you have to go back to the water to wash your hands so that you can eat. If it's more than that, though, don't have to wash your hands. So if it's more than 4 miles ahead of you and more than 1 mile behind you, you can eat without washing your hands. But if it's within those parameters, you gotta get to the water to wash your hands so that you can eat. So Jesus is here, his disciples aren't washing their hands. I mean, they're fishermen. I remember going to the, when we were in Kenya in a little fishing village of Gatkachola on the banks of, the shores of Lake Victoria. And that was a smell. Just the fish, because they're processing the tilapia and everything that they're catching. I can only imagine how fishermen are going to respond to, like, you're going to make me walk how far? You know, this is something that you guys do in Jerusalem. You got 3 springs on there. You can access this stuff. And, you know, as the people who are tied to the temple and the various accoutrements that are there, you have a little bit more access to water, right? You can do these things. But they're saying, why aren't you doing this? And I think that it's interesting what Jesus' response to this was. He says in verse 3, why do you also transgress the commandment of God because of your tradition? When we understand what water means and we understand the symbolism of what water is, as God is using it as a life source for sustenance, God is using it as a cleansing agent for his people. And they're saying, well, it's really not about the cleansing aspect of things. It's about the fact that you're supposed to do this. Hike it down 4 miles or hike it back 1. You got to do this. You're missing the point of what the water is about. Let's go to Ephesians chapter 5. Ephesians chapter 5, verse 26 to 27, nested in here. There's a lot of wonderful instruction for husbands and wives on how to interact with one another. But Ephesians chapter 5, verse 26 and 27, Paul records here, speaking of Jesus, when we're talking about the sacrifice of Christ and how he loved the church so much and gave himself for her, verse 26, that he might sanctify and cleanse her with the washing of water by the word. The point of the sacrifice of Jesus Christ, of him giving his life, was to wash the church. The washing of water by the word, that he might present her to himself a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that she should be holy and without blemish. That's the point of the water. And it always has been the point of the water. That is why through the flood, it was a cleansing of that which was in opposition to God. It was a cleansing of that which was filthy and dirty to make it clean. And water is obviously a necessary component of a baptism. We don't believe in sprinkling or pouring of water over a person when they're baptized. We believe in the tevilah. We teach that full immersion kind of thing because of what water symbolizes, what it means. It's not just a cursory washing of the hands, but it's also not just getting wet. For Jesus, things, but they're missing the point of what the washing and what the water was really for. So we'll cover that in a future sermon, but as we're looking at these components of the baptism of Jesus, we've looked at water, and in the next message, we'll look at another one.